Love it. I'm probably the most musical non-musician I know. I listen to music and consume music voraciously. I've been thinking about this series for a long time because this is the kind of thing that I'm super passionate about and I love talking about. If you find me and bring up a band I'm following or just music in general, you can get me going for a long time. I love talking about music. I love listening to music. I love listening to music with other people. I love going to live shows and hearing live artists. I love singer-songwriters like Matt and some of our other musicians that we have. And Matt, of course, did an amazing job, as he always does here. I've gotten to know Matt, along with a couple of our other musicians, outside of our Sunday morning environment. And I can confirm to you that they are just as cool of people in real life as they are on the stage. We sometimes hold musicians up on this pedestal and think that they're so amazing. And they're just really good at taking their emotions and putting it into music. At least the good ones are. My early exposure to music was complicated. I grew up, as some of you know, in a homeschool Jesus cult where we were raised that rock music was going to steal your soul. And rock music wasn't just the classic things that you thought of like AC/DC and all of that. That was obviously evil to my Christian parents. We were raised to think that anything that had a syncopated beat was evil. This is an actual scan from a wisdom booklet. It's a homeschool curriculum that I was raised with about learning to replace rock music with melodious music. And the advice here is to cleanse your heart and home of any music that has the rock beat, a heavy or subtle beat on beats 2 and 4 and 4/4 time, also called a backbeat. Something that all of us describe as just normal music. In melodious music, the emphasis is on beats 1 and 3 and 4/4 time. Another sensual technique, and I think I might have heard Matt do this a little bit this morning, is called scooping. It involves vocalists starting just below the pitch and sliding up. And that's sensual, in case you didn't realize it. If you ever hear an artist do something like that, they're bringing out those evil carnal desires. And if you cannot locate melodious music, we will be happy to help you. Write to us at Triumphant Music, Box 1 in Oak Brook, Illinois. This was what I was raised in. So it's no surprise that my very first CD player that we got was a little kind of a boombox thing. And we went to buy our first CDs, and we were so excited. I was, 14, 15, 16, somewhere around there. And, of course, we go to the Christian bookstore, and this was my first CD. Glad, the a cappella project. Because when you can't listen to music with a backbeat, that leaves you with hymns, classical music, some big band show tunes, and then lots and lots of a cappella music. So this was the hippest, coolest music I could find. It's not very hip or cool. I'll play you a little clip if you want to hear it. So this is the kind of music I was rocking out to as a teenager. Good stuff, huh? This is what these guys look like back when they were producing music then. And I'm a 16-year-old while other kids are listening to Beck and Nirvana, and I've got Glad. My musical life has come a long way since then. I was raised with all of these restrictions around music and morality and life. And so my first 20 years, which is usually a very formative year or formative period of life in your musical tastes, my first 20 years was skewed in a very odd direction. The music didn't reflect what I either naturally wanted to listen to or even what I enjoyed. I was listening to what I thought was right and good and clean and pure. And the good news is, since then, I've had the opportunity to rebuild my entire musical repertoire, to discover new artists. And the nice thing about being raised, one of the few perks, I guess, to being raised in a homeschool Jesus cult, where you're only listening to stuff like these guys, is that when you're discovering new music later in life, it's just as exciting. It's just that you're doing it way behind schedule. So in my 20s and 30s, there was a period of time where I was a youth pastor. And it was great because I could go through my grunge phase along with all the kids in my youth group. This was the first time I kind of grew my hair out a little bit longer. And we would go to rock shows, and man, did I enjoy rocking it out and really listening to that rock music. And then my musical taste evolved and continued to evolve. And then through the years, I became an avid consumer of music. Something I've done for, I think, since about 2017 or 18 now, is I've kept a monthly playlist of any new music I discover in that month. It can be a song or an album that came out decades ago or a brand new album. And I put it all, if it's something I listen to once or maybe want to go back and listen to again, and if I like it, I'll put it in this bucket. And then I title it with the month and the year. And I've been doing that for years. And it's a form of like a musical journal. I had someone tell that to me the other day, and I never thought about that, but it is. It's a musical journal. It's a log of the music I'm listening to and consuming that is impacting me on a monthly basis. And I can go back and listen to those albums, those tracks, those playlists, anytime. And I can remember oftentimes, just like you probably can, when you hear a certain song or an album, you know how it takes you back? There's certain playlists and certain months and years that are like a really good vintage. I remember really having a great month in May of 2023, and I was finding new artists and albums, and man, that month's playlist was really long. I consume music in a mindful way, and I think of a phrase that David Byrne of the Talking Heads is known to say quite often. He says, some of the best musicians I know are not musicians. Or he sometimes says, some of the best musicians I know don't play an instrument. And David Byrne of the Talking Heads is a pretty eccentric individual, but who loves music and loves pushing the boundaries of music, loves exploring music in all of its forms and facets. And what I hope with this series is for all of us to first rediscover that love of music that maybe has kind of dimmed over the years. Because chances are probably most of you have an era of your life, a period of time, where you were hitting all the concerts and you were going to all the shows and you were really developing your musical taste. And then life comes along, and then those musical tastes oftentimes harden, they solidify, they calcify over time, and then they become set into well-worn grooves. That's why for most people, they don't listen to, past their 60s, to the newer top 40 music or the stuff that kids are listening to these days. Because it sounds so totally different to what they grew up with, what they're familiar with, what you're comfortable with. There's a way that we can engage with music that we know that actually tickles our brain, and it rewards us because our brain likes to see things completed along a certain trajectory. And when there's a song that has a melody to it, and we can predict that melody and know where it goes, our brain feels satisfaction from hearing that melody played out, from hearing those chords resolved at the end of the song. As people, as human beings, we're born with an innate appreciation for music. We are musical before we are verbal. If you go up to a baby, a newborn baby, you don't have to say any words that make sense. You can talk complete gibberish to them. But if you're saying it with a smile and with a goo-goo-ga-ga tone, they're going to respond to the tone. Because infants respond to musical tones and shifts. They can tell happiness and sadness and stress from the tones of our voices even before they understand words. And as we talked about in pre-talk a little bit this morning, not only are we musical before we are verbal, but that musical love and appreciation stays with us even long after we lose our verbal abilities. Some of you have had loved ones who in their later years have lost memories of key events in their life, but they can sing a song from their teenage years like it was yesterday. Music therapy is such an enriching practice for those in hospice work, especially for those on their last weeks where they're not communicating as much verbally and their caretakers feel like they're not connecting with them. And then you get a musician or someone with a guitar to play a song that they know and to see the response. We're musical to our core before we were even verbal. Here's some examples. How would we say this phrase right here? Say it out loud. Oh, that was beautiful. So musical. It's got a little musical. Oh, so this is like how if we see a cute little puppy, we would say, aww, right? Or if we go to the ice cream shop and then we get up there and we ask for a pistachio fudge and they say, I'm sorry, we're all out. Then we would say, aww. Oh, so we say a little bit differently, don't we? How about this one? Ooh, exciting. I have another box of pistachio fudge in the back. Ooh, okay. But I'm sorry, we are not allowed to use that today. Ugh. How about this one? Hey, okay, you see somebody you haven't seen in a while. A friend, hey, that tonality that goes up. Or when something really, really bad happens. No. Our kids are really good at that one there. Toddlers are really good at expressing that. And to add that extra musical inflection, no, it just sounds like the end of the world. How about this one? Uh-oh. This is kind of a Western phrase that has its own melodic pitch. Uh-oh, uh-oh. That's why infants and kids and toddlers can learn phrases like that so quickly. A baby who is not speaking yet can learn to say, uh-oh, 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 because we're musical before we're verbal. Certain phrases can be said to have different meanings depending on the inflection we put on it. So if I were to suggest that after C3 today, we were all going to meet up at the Unicorn and have lunch and drinks, we would say, oh, great idea, okay? But what if I said that instead of going to the Unicorn, we're going to go to McDonald's and all get hash browns? And you know it's a bad idea, but you don't want to hurt my feelings. So we use something called sarcasm, and we say something like, oh, great idea. Sarcasm is all about pitch and melody. You can say the same thing seriously, and you can say it sarcastically, and it's all about the pitch and the tone. We're wired to not only appreciate music, but to recognize music very, very early. I'm going to do these little tests here. We're going to see how well you do at this. These are 1 second or less, in some cases, one note of a song. These are some well-known songs that most of you should know. So let's try this and see how well you do at recognizing it. Here's this first one. Wow, you got on the first one. Here's that again for anybody who didn't catch it. Listen close. Got that? Okay, so there we go. So that's Michael Jackson's Beat It. Very good. Now let's try another one here. Okay, here's one more time. Listen close. You hear that? Go one more time. Some of you said it. There you go. It's the YMCA. Good job. And we're all going to do the YMCA. Oh, great idea. Okay. Here's another one for you. Listen close. That was good. We got some classical music lovers. There we go. Here's another one. Listen. Yeah, there we go. We got some Journey fans in here. Here we go. One more time. Right. Journey. Okay, good. Here's another one here. Let's listen close. Listen close. David got it. Good, good, good. All right, here we go. It's a really quiet one. Listen. Listen. It's just one note. There we go. Okay. Yeah, there we go. Just one note. Thank you. I'm so glad you got that in the first time. I'd have been a little bit embarrassed if you didn't. Yeah, so that's John Williams. Just that opening crash is so instantly recognizable. How about that one? It's a Pride Month tune. Okay. So you get how this works, right? We have this ability to recognize our brains, our consciousness has co-evolved with music. Now, there's lots of anthropologists and people who study this and have studied the formation of music and why we would have needed it evolutionarily. And we know that within the larger animal kingdom, we're not the only ones capable of creating music. There are all sorts of creatures, from birds with their beautiful bird song to the whales in the ocean creating these long, sometimes 45, 55-minute long songs that don't even have repeating elements. They're just long, single compositions. We're musical creatures on a planet with sounds all around us. And music is what helps us to express emotions, to shape identity. There is a way that we can communicate things with music that we can't with words alone. I could read the lyrics to a song to you, and even my best delivery is not going to have the same emotional impact as a guitar or a piano accompaniment and a good vocalist. Susan Rogers, in her book called This Is What It Sounds Like, she talks about a personal music identity. She calls it a personal identity. And she says personal identity is a dynamic phenomenon. It changes across time and circumstances. It's in flux most dramatically when we are young and trying to figure out who we want to be and who we could be. That's why for most of us, chances are your musical tastes first formed in your teenage to early 20 years. And maybe it just stopped and never really grew beyond that. Perhaps, though, later in life, you may have either picked up an instrument or had a child or a friend, or you started hanging out with people, and then they started introducing you to new music. So while this early personal identity is formed in our childhood and in our early formative years, that's not the only time that our musical tastes are shaped. That's just the most common and the most well-known in developmental psychology. Music and lyrics in particular, she says, serves as a kind of an encyclopedia of personas. This was such a fascinating idea for me. Music and lyrics serves as a encyclopedia of personas for us to explore and adopt. Lyrics provide us with a private dressing room to try on the words of others to see if we can fit them into our own persona. That's why music is so important for a teenager. If you've raised kids or have nieces and nephews, you know the common state of a teenager is headphones in their ear and a phone in front of their face. And for so many teens, music is deeply connected with their sense of identity, especially kids who are in unsafe homes or experiencing trauma, difficulty at school. Music can become a lifeline for those children because it allows them to give words to their emotions and feelings when they are simply not capable of doing that themselves. We all know that our prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that causes us to think logically and clearly, doesn't fully develop until we're later into our 20s. But the music we listen to, those emotions that we feel, run so much deeper than the prefrontal cortex. To appreciate a song, we don't have to be able to know the keys that it was played in. We don't have to know how to reproduce it. We don't have to have a good voice. We don't have to do any of those things. To appreciate it, we just simply need to open ourselves to it and allow the music to connect with us. And if a song has been written well by a songwriter who's writing from a place of real emotion, then those emotions are conveyed through that song. And then the person on the other side is impacted. Anybody who's ever heard songs about suicide, for example, there's an artist who did a song, Logic, who did a song on suicide that had the number for the hotline. And that song was one of his first viral songs that just blew up because there were so many kids, so many people who listened to that song and they found something in that song that they resonated with. And they're like, this song means something to me. We brought up this morning the song Plowshare Prayer by Spencer LaJoy. Every time Spencer comes and plays that song, even though we've heard it, some of us, maybe dozens of times, moves me in a powerful way. Because there's something about those lyrics and the place that Spencer wrote those lyrics from that connect with me and my story and where I'm at here and now, and the story of so many other who have been abused by religious systems and high control religion. A song can have a powerful effect on people. The music we love often reveals something about who we were. So remember, in our developmental years, we can kind of do a little bit of anthropology work and say, what type of home life did you experiencing growing up? What type of songs were part of your childhood? How did they shape you? If you grew up in the 60s and in the era of political expression and social justice songs and protest songs, those songs and those messages shape you. So the music is often reveals something about who we were, who we needed to be, and who we were becoming. When I was a youth pastor, I did one challenge with my youth group, and they won, and I cut my hair into a mohawk, dyed it bright orange, and kept it for a week. And I loved it. I loved going as many places as I could, shopping, Walmart, didn't matter, because you could feel everybody's eyes on your back as you walk by, and they turn and look at you. And that experience really taught me something because I felt for a week what it felt like to be a goth kid, a rocker, a punk rocker, a miscreant, you know, all these things that people look at in the youth and like, ah, pull your pants up. What are you doing? What are you listening to? You know, and I felt for a moment what it felt like to be in those shoes and to receive attention to know that eyes were looking at you, that people were thinking things about you. So your music oftentimes will reveal about who you needed to be. Some of the most interesting people to me are young kids, and especially when I was youth pastoring, some of the young kids who would, you know, adopt the full goth persona with the chains and the dog collars and listen to all this heavy music are some of the nicest, sweetest, most adorable students. Their music simply is reflecting who they need to be. It gives them a sense of safety and identity to identify with sometimes these really, really dark, disturbed artists or bands because it connects with something in them. David Byrne, again, from the Talking Heads, he said in his book that he wrote called How Music Works, he said, song references are like emotional shortcuts and social acronyms. It's true, isn't it? I can tell you something with my words, but if I use a piece of music that you and I both know, it's instant shorthand that connects us, which is why concerts and live music are so powerful. In the weeks ahead, we're going to be getting into all the different ways that music connects us, but I want to spend some time especially thinking about how music connects us in groups. Because if you're not regularly or at least semi-regularly going out and listening to or singing music in large settings with other people, you're missing out on one of the key ways to be human. In the same way that we know that there are birds who sing songs for audiences, and there are whales who have whale songs that they share, and then they take musical elements of that and pass that on, and then it's shared and grows. We know that this sharing of music and musical language is a part of who we are. It allows us to connect with this emotional shortcut or social shorthand. And listening is a practice. So throughout this series, we're going to come back to this idea about practicing listening to music, which sounds funny. You've probably practiced playing music before. Has anybody taken any type of musical instrument lessons at any point in your life? Raise your hand. Let me see. Most of us have. How many of you still play the instrument that you were? Okay, a lot less. We've all probably tried our hand at playing music. But did you know that listening to music is an art? It's something you can practice, something you can develop, you can get better at. If your musical library feels blah, if it has all of the emotional energy of a beige minivan, and you need some fresh music to connect with, the good news is music is still being created today, and it is easier than ever to access it, even if it is gatekept by some large companies and corporations. I'm here to tell you, as someone who changed and developed his own musical taste much later in life and then continued to grow and develop my musical taste, some of my most enjoyable times of appreciating music happens right here and now in this time that I'm living in. I don't have to look back on that one U2 concert from 15 years ago or that one show from 20 years ago that was such a good time, because I can still appreciate and live music now. So we're going to be talking in this series about how to develop listening as a practice, how to get better at listening to music. Again, Susan Rogers, in This Is What It Sounds Like, she says, listening is not the same as hearing. It's an active process, not a passive one. See, many of you think you listen to music when you're just, many of you think you're listening to it when you're simply hearing it. if it's on in the background, if you're doing other things, that's great, and that's a wonderful use of music. I play music in the background all the time when I'm working or doing other things. But there is a different posture that it takes to actively listen to music rather than passively hearing it. And becoming a competent musical listener, she says, requires curiosity, effort, and love. And if you're willing to bring a little bit of curiosity and wonder to this series, then this summer I think that your musical world could possibly expand a little bit. There's some new artists waiting for you to discover that have songs that are connecting with where you are at in life or situations that you're going through. And those songs are like gifts from the artist to you. When an artist goes through a period of hurt, brokenness, disappointment, betrayal, and then they take those emotions and transform them into a song and then share that song with you, and you going through something similar resonate with the things in that song, that is such a beautiful gift of exchange between two human beings, in some cases two human beings that may never meet one another. To connect with a gift that an artist leaves behind as a time capsule, to say, this was a hard time I went through, and I wrote this song, and now this song is a gift for you for when you go through a hard time. Or, if you need more happiness and joy in your life, there's plenty of playlists for that too. If you haven't put on a really good dancing playlist and danced in your kitchen recently, I'm hoping that by the end of this series, some of you may give that a try. Learning to love and appreciate music is what this series is going to be about, and I'm excited to share this with you. Before I take the stage, or leave the stage, I want to tell you about next week, because next week is kind of tied in, but it's going to be a little bit different. Next week is going to be our Pride Sunday. We've just started, we're in June, so happy Pride Month to all of you. This is Pride Month, and next Saturday is the Grand Haven Pride Festival. The next day, on the 14th, is our Pride Sunday, and we have Jay Kaplan, who is a staff attorney for Michigan's ACLU, the LGBTQ plus project. So he's been working for over 11, 12 years now. I think he last spoke at C3 over 10 years ago. He's a dynamic, engaging speaker. I'm really looking forward to him. And then we have Grace Tyson, who we've had in the past, but she's coming with her trio, the Grace Tyson Trio. So it's going to be a special Sunday. Really, really excited for that Pride Sunday next week. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then after that, we're going to just keep rolling ahead, exploring music and the ways that music connects with us in our lives. It's going to be a lot of fun. Thank you for joining us this morning. Let's have Matt come back up and share some more amazing music with us as part of our Summer of Sound.